Hello and welcome to The Detail. I'm Katie Melua.
And I'm Polly Scatkin.
This is a podcast where through conversation we dive into a certain detail of making records and writing songs. We're joined today by Nerina Paolo, who has released 6 studio albums and been nominated for both a Brit and Ivor Novello Award. And she's written songs with many great artists, including Kylie Minogue.
Welcome to The Detail. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me, Polly Scattergood, in my studio at home. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to show your support. The address is patreon.com/Polly Scattergood. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
The topic for today is the notion of the muse. It's an aspect people touch upon but not often discuss in great detail. And yet, Nerina, as you wrote recently, it's that fundamental part of it that always feels so elusive and yet very personal. There have been many well-documented examples of artists and musicians working with muses: Patti Smith and photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, Leonard Cohen and Marianne. George Harrison and Eric Clapton famously both had Patti Boyd as their muse. So, Nerina, could we open with the first time you were consciously aware you were working with a muse for a record?
Wow, that's a really good question. That's a really hard one to answer. I think in a way, I feel like I'm always working with a muse in the sense that, I mean, I don't know how to say this without giving people the wrong impression that I'm some kind of crazy God botherer. but I'm going to go with it because it's something I've had since I was very, very little. And I think I was brought up in quite a religious Catholic setting, which I've subsequently, you know, I've had recovery from that. But I think when I was little, I was just so in love with music and I felt like it didn't come from the everyday world, and I felt like it belonged to God. And when I was small, I can remember going to church, and I really loved singing hymns and things, and making a pact with God that I would, if he'd let me make music, I would make music for him, which is quite wow. Heavy. Yeah, it feels, and I don't know if that was slightly influenced by watching that movie Amadeus, where Salieri makes a pact with God and says, you know, work through me. But I can remember as a very small child, being 6 or 7, knowing I wanted to do music and feeling like God was the great vending machine in the sky who, if I worked with him, would give me songs. So my first muse, oh my God, I can't believe it, but I can't think of anything. It's honest. It's actually what it was for me, was having a chat with God and saying, God, help me write a song.
That's so remarkable. I mean, and look, I am particularly, you know, not particularly religious, but I've always marvelled at the sheer sort of beauty and the scale of the works of art that were created through the church, you know, throughout history.
Yeah.
You know, like Rachmaninoff, his Vespers, which are just some of the most stunning vocal works ever. You know, and I guess there, I guess when the church commissioned artists to, you know, whether it was creating, you know, a painting on a wall inside a church, or whether it was creating music, to those composers and artists, you know, the divine was the muse. And that's what you're describing too.
Absolutely. I mean, and it has a long history. I mean, if we think of the origination of the muse, I mean, it's a Greek ideal, isn't it, really? Mm-hmm. And so it's really common for everyday, workaday artists, painters, writers, musicians back then to feel that they were looking to the gods for their inspiration, you know, and it was a perfectly acceptable understanding of it. And I think a lot about Bach as well. You know, his main gig was to write a cantata once a week for the church that he was the head musician or head organist of. So he had actually a religious job of music, which is wild.
Wow.
And he made some of the most incredible music ever written for that, through that sort of medium.
That's remarkable. And can I ask, how did that then develop? So as a 6-year-old, you're in church making a pact with God, you know, as then you grow up, you know, and you mentioned that you kind of had treatment for the sort of heavy Catholic upbringing.
Yeah.
You know, what happened later? You know, I mean, I know you studied literature at university and, you know, there's a lot of music that's taken inspiration from literature.
Mm.
But kind of what happened in the intervening years, I guess, from six to before you got to university?
Well, I think, you know, I sort of got normalised by the world and realised it didn't have to be quite so intense. I mean, I was a very intense child. But it hasn't really left me. I mean, I think my cornerstone is always I should write, but also be aware that writing is service. You know, musicians, we are service people above and beyond everything, because effectively what we do is totally useless. But our uselessness is part of our function to mm-hmm. the world. You know, we can't save people's lives with our... I mean, I suppose I come from a family with a lot of medics and people like that in, so I'm acutely aware of how useless I am. but by the same token, what we do is of huge importance to people's spiritual growth, you know, and their emotional needs. So it's about being of service. And I think that as much as I want to make work that's for me, because all artists, we're scratching our own internal muse, aren't we? It's about mm-hmm. making music that pleases us. I also think that you have a duty to make work that speaks to people on a wider level, that helps them in some way. I mean, not every artist has a different... I'm not saying that's the only way to do it, but that is very much, I suppose, when I sit down to write, sometimes I do light a candle, or sometimes I do say a little prayer that I write something that is useful to as many people as it can be.
Wow, that's such a beautiful way of thinking. I'm all for that idea of trying to put something that does some good into the world out there. That's really such a lovely thing that you have in your head before you sit down and write. I wonder if you would have that spirituality anyway, whether or not you had had the religious upbringing, just because many of the musicians and composers that we have spoken to, they all speak of this kind of sense of spirituality, and the sense of sometimes the music is already written. There's this underlying feeling that they go to another place when they write and compose.
Mm. I've just finished the biography of Derrida that came out recently by an author called Peter Salmon. And that book really, you know, so for those that don't know, Derrida was a brilliant 20th century philosopher, and he really highlighted the importance of language. And so what that book has done for me is it's made me realise that conversation itself is a thing, and the titles that we give to... our understanding of the world are titles in themselves, you know, so this idea of another world or like a spirituality, I don't know, I look at it now from a terminology perspective,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I just think life itself is miraculous, and mm-hmm. you kind of mm-hmm. don't really have to look too deeply to go, how on earth is that tree about to like bloom yeah. into thousands of leaves when you can't see anything mm-hmm. at the moment with it. So
did you hear about that thing at the Hadron Collider today? It's so funny you talking. They discovered this beauty quark.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Which is a new, is going to possibly rewrite the laws of physics, but it's exactly that idea that we, all the things we think we know, we don't know anything. And part of that is we miss so much beauty because we take so many things for granted or face value, mm-hmm. you know, that it is quite, just being alive is a miracle, even though yeah. it doesn't feel like it sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that came up in this book is the idea that language is a repeating format. So, for example, the fact that a horse, we will call every single horse that we encounter a horse. And so it's like, you know, the horse isn't an individual. And it just, again, made me realise that mechanism in language does make us look sort of less, you know, look less deeply. So that's fascinating. And I want to bring this onto one of your songs because we're sort of talking about philosophy here. Your song Rousseau, the 18th century European philosopher. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I guess studying literature, did you go into philosophy much, or how did Rousseau become a muse for one of the songs?
So Rousseau was actually, there are two Rousseaus. There's Henri Rousseau, who was French-Belgian or Belgian, and then there's Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the philosopher, who was either French or Swiss, and he wrote The Social Contract. And basically, it's about both of them. And the painting, I've always loved Rousseau's paintings, and they're set in jungles, and they have tigers, and they're really beautiful. But the guy had never been anywhere near the jungle, and he was ridiculed in his time, and I really loved them. And then I was researching him, and I came across, and I suddenly thought I should really check out the other Rousseau. I had, of course, heard of Rousseau, and I was very bored, and so I decided to read The Social Contract, which is really quite boring. but his idea is, it's a very romantic and essentially sort of quite esoteric idea that there's the noble savage, the idea that we come into this world. It's a very sort of religious idea as well, that we come into this world untainted, and that life, compromise, the systems that keep us alive effectively also take out our naturalism, I guess, and our connection to the world that we belong to, and that education is a brainwashing away from where we really come from. So he was hugely influential in modern sort of education. The way we've all been educated is effectively based on Rousseau's ideals. But it was this idea of, are we born... Man, he said, man is born free but is everywhere in chains. And I really love that sort of... I think there's a dichotomy in life where, you know, we're living through a time where we see that dichotomy all the time. We are being ravaged, not by bombs, but right now, at least in the West, we're being ravaged by a disease we can't see, we can't smell it, we can't touch it. And yet it's beyond all our collective power and all our thousands of years of learning. We are being brought to a standstill and being very humbled by something that is entirely natural, as far as we know. And it's that power of nature, and that when we forget we belong to it, when we forget we're animals, we get very weakened, I think, you know.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to that feeling of connection and a purpose and being able to channel things both externally and inwardly, like being able to channel that through music. And I think if that's taken away, for example, like with lockdown and not being able to go outside and feel the kind of force of life, it changes your perspective on things. And I remember the first time I saw the sea after being in lockdown for so long, and it was like just this amazement at how vast it was, and it was like seeing it through new eyes. It was wonderful.
Yeah, I think, which goes back to what, you know, Katie was just saying about the idea of everything being miraculous, but we live so internally a lot of the time that we only see what's in our own head, or we see through the prism of our own head rather than, I don't know, am I explaining this correctly? It's a bit between, there's an analogy, you know, when you're on a motorbike or when you're in a car, you might be making the same journey, but one is framed and one is without a frame, that you're in the actual action. And I think we've all forgotten how to be in the action, and maybe lockdown allowed us to slow down enough to really savour the space we're in.
I wonder if this approach comes from, you know, the idea that a lot of the sciences have tried to simplify, you know, and have tried to kind of to find like a final sort of solution, or, you know, as in a final formula.
Incontrovertible laws, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that urge for, you know, I mean, let's face it, a lot of male-led institutions, yeah, you know, that desire to really just plunge forward rather than, you know, because I think reality is probably too confusing if one weren't to simplify it into, you know, patterns.
We get, and I think we fear that you know, this idea that maybe not all the laws of physics are written, or maybe we have to rewrite things, I find that exciting. But for some people, that's probably terrifying, because what does that mean about everything that's gone before? Were we wrong? Or what about if things could actually change? You know, that could be... I mean, you imagine how people must have viewed a meteor streaking through the sky 1,000 years ago. Whereas last week, everybody was... there was footage actually from Jersey, where I grew up, fantastic footage of it in the sonic boom. And people were not running around going, God has come to end us all. They were like, wow, it's a meteor. But 1,000 years ago, people would have been like, it's the end for us all.
It is incredible. Narina, you also mentioned that there might be marked differences in what the muse is to a woman and what it is to a man. Is that something we can discuss further?
Yeah, I really would, because I feel like... if you go Google famous muses, for example, and the top 10, it's all nearly all women, and it's all to do with painters. So it's like Camille Claudel for Rodin, he ruined her life. She was a wonderful artist in her own right. But of course, we only think about her in terms of Rodin. You know, we don't think about her. You've got Dora Maar, who Picasso, you know, she was one of his main muses. You're right, Patti Smith. And actually, Mapplethorpe and Patti Smith are kind of each other's muses, weren't they? Mm-hmm. But the history, or Gauguin, is very problematic. That all the young Tahitian kids, effectively. But history is littered with, right back to Dante with Beatrice, you know, this whole idea that all his work was inspired by this woman he saw twice in his life, which is quite deranged, really. But we don't know much about I suppose some might argue there's not many records of famous female artists in until the last 100 years. But we don't know that much about what were women inspired by, or who was inspiring them, or what were they writing for, or, you know, was there a person and who was that person? No one thinks to ask. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you guys have got examples, but...
Well, I just think it's because it was very difficult for women to be artists, you know, because, you know, before the invention of contraception, before the invention of the car, you know, being able to travel and before feminism, really. And I kind of feel like, you know, we are really the first few generations of women being able to be artists and makers and creatives. So I kind of just have to look at us. And I think I'm very inspired by the men, particularly the men that I work with, because, you know, they're very, especially ones that are really great at what they do.
Yeah, and if they're willing to teach you the things they know as well, it's kind of... it's a two-way street in that way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. No, definitely.
Narina, I don't know if you're happy with talking about this, but stop me if you're not. But you work very closely with your partner, Andrew Chatterley.
Yeah.
And I was just interested about how, obviously, this whole podcast is about the muse. And I had a very interesting conversation with Katie where we were discussing if we had muses, and she automatically assumed that my partner, Glenn, who is my producer, was my muse. And I had never thought in that way. And I always felt like I drew inspiration from other things. But I guess when she said that, it made me realize that there was this sort of running thread and a sound that being with him brings. I wondered if you have any thoughts on that and what your experience of working so closely with your partner is.
That's a really good question. I don't know that Andrew is my muse. I would say he's my subject a lot of the time. And then my sort of co-conspirator. So he's the subject of lots of songs of mine. And I probably wrote... So anyway, he is a muse because I do write to impress him sometimes, like what he thinks... really, it does matter. But then I think of that in the sense that a lot of writers, like literature writers I know, have an ideal reader. So in a sense, Andrew's often my ideal listener. But the muse for me is never really a person. I feel like it has to go beyond an individual.
Yeah, I think it's I don't know. I think there's been lots of songs that have been directed, you know, at, let's use the word muse. You know, so when you wanted to get something off your chest, I mean, I remember, you know, maybe I'm kind of turning the topic of having your heart broken to the idea of a muse. But, you know, I remember when I had my first sort of big heartbreak, the song I wrote piece by piece was directed at, you know, my ex at the time. And so I've kind of always thought of he was the muse for that song. And in a way, the breakup of the relationship was also the muse for that song. So yeah, there are, you know, there's that way of looking at it, definitely.
Yeah, I think that in that sense, then I think we've all had many muses, haven't we, on a more subjective everyday, what I think of as a mundane muse, because we should never give exes or people who've broken our heart that much power. I don't think we should transcend their mundanity.
For sure.
So that's right. You know, make it something. I mean, all of us have, it's that idea of pain being very personal, but also very universal, isn't it? So the person that might have inspired it won't necessarily, it doesn't, the person who listens and feels moved by your work won't necessarily know that person. So that's where I think the muse comes in, that it's another level that transcends that personal subjectivity.
Mm-hmm. I was curious also about another work of yours, Narina, The Sound and the Fury, which of course is from the book by William Faulkner. Was that, how did that use the notion of the muse or the, you know, or some of the elements from this book, or was it just the title?
No, no one ever asked me about that song or that record. That was very led by two things. It was led by literature. It was led by two books, the Faulkner, as you mentioned, and also a book by Cormac McCarthy called The Road. And it was, the muse in this album is really my son. It was the first album I'd made since I had been pregnant and had a child, meaning that The Year of the Wolf was made while I was pregnant, so I hadn't really been a parent on the last record. Mm-hmm. Then I became a parent. Then I suddenly felt this urgency to sort of talk to my child in the future. And I was very specific about what kind of language. I wanted to use quite biblical language in that record. And so that is a very... it's like a quite an abstract record in the sense that I wasn't writing from all the feels, if that makes sense. I was writing from a place of having a job I needed to do. And I wanted to use, I suppose I read a few little Bible passages as well to get the tone right of like another voice. So there's no song on the album called The Sound and the Fury, but there's a song called The Road, which has a line, it's maybe in The Sound and Fury. And it's that idea of stilling all your senses, all the mental chatter, all the noise of the world outside, and finding, which I guess is when we talk about the muse, we talk about all artists, songwriters, filmmakers, writers of literature. We all talk about when we're in the zone, we are out of ourselves, aren't we? We're not aware of making work. We're not aware of how... I bet if we all sat down and tried to talk about our favourite or what we consider our best songs, we wrote them fast and in the blink of an eye and can't remember writing them. Would I be right?
Sadly, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we weren't... It wasn't like we were there, and we never know how those things happen. And my personal view is, and it's not a Catholic God or a Buddhist God, it's just the idea that actually in those moments, God is talking through you. And it's... being still enough to let that in everything. It doesn't have to be when you're making work, but just to let the stillness of like a universal, which is the muse, going, I'm going to work through you, and now we're going to do something together, and I'm not going to get in your way, and you're not going to get in my way, and that's how we roll.
I mean, it's such a
hard... Does that make sense?
It really does, and it's such a hard thing to describe, and you have kind of just put it into words so eloquently. It's... yeah, that sense of stillness and being able to channel, I think, is is crucial, isn't it? Can I ask another quite personal question? Have you ever hidden behind a muse in order to kind of deflect what the true meaning of a song is? You know, have you ever said, oh, it's about this book or this film, and actually it's, you know, about something much deeper than
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I do. And I'm not very original in what I hide behind. I just generally tend to go and find a bit of mythology with a symbolic mm-hmm. figure. So, you know, there's a song from my very first album called Daphne and Apollo, which is basically wishing the bloke I really fancied would chase me the way that Apollo chased Daphne, but he didn't. And then there's a song on my last record called Juno, and Juno is like the goddess of life, and I just wanted to mm-hmm. help someone. It's almost that idea of wanting to recreate a life for someone without talking about a specific situation, but using an analogy. That's why mythology is so useful, you know, you mm-hmm. can hide behind it. And then people think you're dead clever, but actually you're just trying to tell someone you fancy them.
Can I ask a bit of a curveball question here? You've worked, obviously, with Kylie Minogue, and I was wondering, on that day when you were writing for her, was she the muse, or did she come to you with that initial idea or inspiration? How did it work?
Yeah, that was a dream sort of writing situation, because I didn't actually write with her, I wrote for her, and we worked together. And it's interesting because this actually does come back very closely to the muse. So she was, you know, talking about making, it was effectively a comeback record after having battled cancer and been away for a while and wanting to embrace who she was at that point in her life. And somehow we got onto the concept of her, you know, the being a princess of pop or a goddess of pop. And she went away and I thought about it and I thought, yeah, she's got that kind of otherworldliness. You know, she's like a sylph from another world. And mm-hmm. and then, of course, I lack imagination. So I came up with the idea of Aphrodite and this whole thing. And she loved it. And she loved the idea. So I ran with it. And it was about reimagining her as this. Some of the goddesses, I love them because they can be really powerful and really spiteful, but really sweet at the same time. You know, they'll grant you wishes, but they'll also chop your legs off if you displease them. So that's what Kylie has. She has this lightness of power, but it's a power, you know. And I don't know if either of you seen her live, but there's something radiant about her. So that was fantastic because it was allowing me to craft something and sort of role play. And it was a dream because it also allowed me to do that. But what I did find from that world and the co-writing world, and I think we've all been there, all three of us, is when I move into a co-writing situation, I immediately feel like the mechanics of commerce are at play, and I feel very dirty somehow. And yeah. I've tried it, but I can't get past the feeling of it being, I don't know.
That's not right. So interesting. Why do you think that is? Let's dive into that, because that's fascinating.
Because writing, I guess for me, and it's interesting, in the course of this is like therapy. I've realised something about myself. It's no wonder that I find it so hard. If as a six-year-old child I said to God, I'll work with you, God, you're my only co-writer, which sounds completely nuts. No wonder I find it really hard to sit in a room with people, because I feel like the moment you're sitting in a room, you're saying, we're going to write a song for a purpose other than... Oh, I don't know. It just feels like, why can't I just be honest and personal in a private, deeply private way, you know?
I think deeply personal and private is probably the most perfect line we could have hoped for to end a podcast all about the muse.
That's so wonderful. Narina, thank you so much for being part of today's show. We're truly lucky to have had you as a guest today.
Oh, you're welcome.
We really are. Thank you, Narina.
That's all from us. You've been listening to The Detail, a podcast by me, Katie Mellower.
And me, Polly Scattercood.
Thanks for tuning in.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me in my studio. studio. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to give your support. The address is patreon.com/PollyScattergood. Thanks so much.